You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. The Music Man. Mark Ronson has helped craft the albums of some of the biggest recording stars of the century, Amy, Gaga, Miley, Bruno, Adele. Now, the producer and DJ is stepping into the spotlight himself, by Lisa Robinson. Photographs by Stas Komorowski, styled by Tony Irvine. For some quotes, this from Miley Cyrus. When working with Mark, I'm always amazed at how he makes a song feel classic and new all at the same time. Throwback, but modern. Alicia Keys said, I love how much Mark is all about the music. He is so passionate about creating something unforgettable. And this from Sean Lennon. Mark has always been brilliant. He's what you get when you combine immense talent with an unwavering commitment and work ethic. Opening photo, sound design, Mark Ronson, photographed at his studio in Los Angeles. Electric Lady Studios, Greenwich Village, New York City. From its inception, it was known as Jimi Hendrix Manhattan Recording Studio. In 1970, he converted a former club into a studio. The building was distinguished by a curved red brick wall on the outside and psychedelic murals on the walls inside. Many musicians have recorded here: the Rolling Stones, David Bowie, Led Zeppelin, The Clash, J. Cole, Prince, Patti Smith, Kendrick Lamar, and numerous and legendary others. Today, Mount Sinai Hospital has taken over part of the building. The curved brick wall is gone, and only one door identifies the historic recording studio. Inside, three flights up, no elevator, the musician-producer Mark Ronson is putting the finishing touches on a song he'll record the next day with the radio host Howard Stern. Mark has produced music for Amy Winehouse, Bruno Mars, Adele, Lady Gaga, Queens of the Stone Age, worked with Diplo and others, both numerous and legendary. So why is he doing a song with Howard Stern? Because, he tells me, he grew up in New York City as a fan of Stern's early radio show. Now he says that listening to him in the car in L.A. is one of the things that makes living there more bearable. Also, Howard asked him to do it. Mark Ronson is tall and handsome, with great hair and a dashing style that he claims he only washes and combs. He's wearing dark pants, vintage sneakers, and most notably a Heartbreakers t-shirt. Not Tom Petty's Heartbreakers, but the 1970s Heartbreakers fronted by the late former New York Dolls guitarist Johnny Thunders, beloved by fans of great sloppy rock and roll. Mark, 43, lived in London until he was 8 years old, before moving to New York City. He would never have heard the Dolls or the Heartbreakers play live. Both bands had broken up, and Thunders died of a rumored drug overdose in 1991. Still, game recognizes game. Mark grew up obsessed with mainstream rock, AC/DC, Guns N' Roses, rhythm-based funk, R&B, and then rap, and he's always had a feel for the real thing. Even before this past year, when he won Grammys, a Golden Globe, and the Oscar for Shallow from A Star Is Born, along with co-writers Lady Gaga, Andrew Wyatt, and Anthony Rosimondo, Mark was considered a go-to producer. We sit on a leatherette sofa in the studio's lounge, and he points to hundreds of Polaroid pictures on the wall, including one of his first manager, the late Dominic Trenier, who had been a contemporary of Andre Harrell and Sean Puffy Combs. Mark comes from a musical family. As a child in London, his parents always had music on in the house and parties where he would join in and play air drums. At age 8, following his parents' divorce, he moved to Manhattan with his mother and stepfather, foreigner guitarist Mick Jones. Much has been made of Mark's family. His mother is the jewelry designer Ann Dexter Jones. His twin sisters are designer Charlotte and DJ Samantha. And there is a large extended family of other Ronson and Jones brothers and sisters. But anyone who knows Mark knows that this is beside the point. What is key to his entire being is how much he was and is in love with making music. As a teenager, he was in a variety of bands, some influenced by bands from the Black Rock Coalition, like Living Color. He says he wasn't nearly as accomplished on guitar as his childhood friend Sean Lennon. "One of my bands sounded like the Black Crows, with a rapper on top," Mark tells me, "only not as good as the Black Crows." He says he wanted to DJ because he couldn't do what he wanted to do in that band. He was always determined, and he always worked hard. After he got turntables and an MPC for his high school graduation, he became obsessed with sampling and hip-hop. "My drive was that I effing loved this shit," he tells me. "Any rapper I'd meet in a club, I'd ask, 'Want to come to my house and make some music?'" In hip-hop, it wasn't so much where you were from, it was where you were at. Mark frequented clubs, but he wasn't some rich kid who sneaked into Studio 54 with his parents' gold membership card. He went to hip-hop joints. At age 17, he made $75 for his first DJ gig at a bar on 2nd Avenue. He recalls that it was during a snowstorm. He had to haul his own PA system, and he lost money on the job. He frequented life on Bleecker Street, now Poisson Rouge, where, back in the 1990s, the club's DJ played dreamy Euro music. Mark consistently begged the owner to let him DJ, and one night he took over the turntables. He played a combo of AC/DC and Chaka Khan, 70 Soul and Biggie, and he says, "I decided I was just going to effing kill it, and I don't think they'd ever seen people dancing on the tables like that. It became my residency." Quickly, his Friday night sets became a thing. Among those who regularly stopped by to check him out, Rick Rubin, Jay-Z, Chris Rock, Prince, Mariah Carey, Puffy, and others who, along with the fashion crowd, hired Mark to DJ their parties. When Dominic Trenier discovered Mark at Life, he arranged for Mark to co-produce the 2001 U.S. debut album, Everybody Got Their Something, for Nika Costa, a singer and the daughter of Frank Sinatra's arranger-conductor Don Costa. Mark tells me he had no clue what to do in the recording studio, but he says that having been a DJ, being immersed in beat culture, and coming from a large family of colorful characters helped him learn how to produce records. The Nika Costa album created a lot of hype, didn't sell very well in the U.S., but caused a stir in England, where his next project was a solo album. Here Comes the Fuzz, in 2003, which included contributions from Mos Def, Q-Tip, and others. That was followed by his album of covers, Version. "I wanted to make a Radiohead album with the James Brown vibe. I did it for my own enjoyment. The difference between my own records and records I produce for other people is that my solo records originate from a sonic or conceptual idea that I'm inspired by, one that wouldn't make sense on anyone else's record." His solo work got him noticed in England and eventually led him to work with the woman he calls the most iconic female artist of this generation, Amy Winehouse. In the photos, record collection. "I just think he's a living legend." Says Dua Lipa, who won Best New Artist at this year's Grammys. And Ronson sits on the sofa, gold records behind him. And family ties. Ronson, at age 11, with stepfather and Foreigner guitarist Mick Jones, mother Anne, sisters Charlotte and Samantha, and half-sister Annabelle, New York City, 1986. Mark better never lose his phone. His contacts include every major singer, musician, rapper, and sideman in the business. Ever since working with Amy Winehouse in 2006 on the multi-Grammy-winning Back to Black, with the exception of a period in 2011 and 2012 that he describes to me as a down, dark time, I was partying too much, stumbling out of clubs like I was Oasis's Liam Gallagher. It's been nothing but one amazing project after another. Among Mark's work was a 2018 tribute single for what would have been Michael Jackson's 60th birthday that combined several of the singer's hits. Mark didn't comment on the renewed allegations against Jackson of child molestation. He's worked with musicians as diverse as Paul McCartney and Romy Madley Croft of the XX and Queens of the Stone Age, whose leader, Josh Homme, says he appreciates talented folks without trying to change, fix, or judge them. He's a positive guy, an attitude and optimism. He's a great musician across the board, but his skill is hiding his own. Mark has a poker face that belies a dry, sardonic wit. He also is modest to the point of self-effacement. He's in therapy, which he says he likes, and admits to all sorts of anxieties. He tells me he used to think that every record he worked on would be his last. The day we won the Grammy for Record of the Year for Uptown Funk, I thought, oh God, this will never happen again. I've been faking it all along. But now, he says, he's getting better. I don't have golden ears where I can tell a hit song. If you play me 10 songs and ask me which one Selena Gomez should record tomorrow, I won't necessarily know. There have been times when I thought I didn't know what the F I was doing, but I'll know it when I hit it. At some point, you get better about it and think, okay, this is what's got me up to here, so maybe I'm not so embarrassed or annoyed by my neuroses. I just have to accept that it's part of me, embrace it. It got me to where I am, so F it. So, Amy, recalling the day they met in 2006 and the way they worked together, Mark says, I think Amy was the first one who came around and said, you can do this on your own terms. You can do something that's exciting and a little bit left of center that can capture the mainstream. She was influenced by jazz. All her chords came from jazz, and she would show me diagrams of chords. At this point in our conversation, Mark shows me Amy's handwritten lyrics to Back to Black, which he keeps under framed glass, with little hearts drawn in and the chords written out. She was totally straight when we worked together, he says. Everyone was telling me, oh, you're working with Amy Winehouse? She's been working on that record for 3 years. But I met her, and we started working that day. We did 5 songs in 3 days. She was like a honed, laser-sharp machine. I was lucky to meet her when she got sober. She had sorted herself out, and we just hit a vibe. The 6 songs I did with her were done in, like, 10 days. There was such an instant bond, and even though she was from North London, there was that humor and that Jewish thing we both had. She would say, you're the big sister I never wanted. She was someone I could have been friends with for my whole life. One day we were walking, he continues, and she said she used to be pretty effed up, and people would come to the house, and there'd be broken glasses and blood on the walls. And she said her dad and her manager came around, and they tried to make me go to rehab, and I was like, no, no, no. I told her that because she was talking about it with such distance, and this was such a heartfelt story, and there was something hooky about what she just said, we should go back to the studio and try to write a song. So she went to the back room at Sorcerer Studios and came back with a 2-bar blues. And, of course, my inner DJ was thinking, can we make it a little faster? She really is the only person I saw who could write a song in 40 minutes. She had no filter. I remember asking her on the song Back to Black to change a lyric because it didn't rhyme. And the thought of changing a lyric, well, she wasn't indignant that I asked her, but it was like, how could I change it? That's what I wrote. How could I change it to make it rhyme? And my pop brain was like, well, we do it all the time. But she said, this is the emotion. This is what I felt. I can't change one word. She was so honest, and I thought, not everybody is so uncompromising and talented enough to do that. After the massive success of that album, she won 5 Grammys, and he won Producer of the Year. Even though she went back to a drugged-up life, he says he never expected her to die. I guess, for all the drinking and partying I'd done, I'd never been close to someone experimenting with hard drugs, so I guess I was a little naive. After that album, he had a bit of a downturn between Amy and 2014's Uptown Funk, the ubiquitous single with Bruno Mars that appeared on Mark's 4th solo album, Uptown Special. According to Mark, I knew when I was doing that record that it had to be the best thing I'd ever done, or no one would care anymore. It could have been a song on Bruno's record, but because I was in the middle of making my record, it ended up on my record. I'm eternally grateful for that, and being able to go on Saturday Night Live with Bruno fronting that 2014 performance, obviously for a minute I was the luckiest sideman in the world. I know what I added to it, but is the bulk of it Bruno? Of course, I'd be totally honest and say that Bruno wrote 75% of that song. I ask if the song, which took 7 months to make and is still played at basketball games, weddings, and any time dancing is involved, made him super rich. No, he says, because by the time you divide up the publishing between all the writers of the song, along with the inevitable lawsuit from someone who then gets added as one of the writers, I mean, of course we did okay, and it gave me a platform in this country. I didn't have that in the U.S., because my solo success had all been in England. It gives you name recognition, leeway, and power for your next record. It gives you 6 years in the pop world to be relevant. He adds, Bruno said the funniest thing. He said, how come every time it's on the radio or on iTunes, it's Mark Ronson featuring Bruno Mars, and every time we get sued, it's Bruno Mars featuring Mark Ronson? Mark tells me he's never been romantically involved with any of the women he's worked with. It seems like it would be a huge minefield, he says. He describes himself as a romantic who's always been in long-term relationships. There was Quincy Jones's daughter, Rashida, who remains a good friend. In 2011, he married the model and actress Josephine de la Baume. In 2018, they got divorced, and he is reluctant to discuss what happened, saying they have a good relationship. And he adds, it's tough. We were together for 8 years and married for 5. We are two people who really loved each other and had a history and the best of intentions, and it just didn't work out. A conversation follows between the two of us about how difficult it can be to maintain a marriage when someone is obsessed with work. How, during dinner, you could be thinking of getting back to the studio to fix a drum part, or a bass line that isn't quite right. According to Sean Lennon, Mark often reminds me of a prize fighter or an Olympic athlete. He's able to block out the world entirely in order to focus on a task at hand. Mark says, when I want a project, I definitely go all in, and whatever effect it has on your life, for better or worse, I'm fully immersed. But I think I've gotten a little bit better at figuring out when you can cut out. Instead of saying Instead of staying in the studio until 2 a.m., I can leave at 10 p.m. He admits that he's been seeing someone new, but didn't want to talk about it because he said it felt important and he didn't want to jinx it. He did say, however, with perturbed amusement, that the woman's name, Rebecca Schwartz, wound up on his Wikipedia page. He has no idea who put that up there. Mark executive produced Lady Gaga's 2016 album, Joanne, which led to co-writing the Oscar-winning song, Shallow. Mark tells me he went to see A Star Is Born, thinking he'd rehearse a few nonpartisan things to say if he didn't think it was amazing. But he says, I couldn't believe I just spent 7 months in the studio with her in extremely close quarters. For someone who's one of the biggest pop stars in the world, to be able to make you believe she's an unknown, I was instantly fully in. The minute she was throwing the trash in the alley. Movies about music are usually done so badly, but this one got everything right. And for this song to be in the moral fiber of the movie, well, I'm very grateful to be a part of it. Dua Lipa, who's working with Mark on her next album, says, one of the things I love about Mark is how he brings artists together and everything feels so collaborative. And so Mark's fifth solo album, Late Night Feelings, out in June, is marked by one amazing female vocalist after another. He describes the album as a DJ breakup record. It's the most modern sounding record I've ever made. He says the mood and the lyrics reflect the melancholy he feels about the breakup of his marriage. This album is all female vocalist, but it wasn't by design. I knew what I wanted to say on this record, and you just find the people who are going to be your best sparring partners. People who were willing to go to the heartbreak zone a little bit. The difference between Late Night Feelings and my previous solo records is that this one came from an emotional place rather than a conceptual one. It's the first time I had no choice but to put my own honesty and realness first, instead of a kitschy or interesting concept. However, from the first second of this album to the last, you cannot help but want to get up and dance. Mark's inner DJ at work. Even the song Miley Cyrus sings, Nothing Breaks Like a Heart, is a catchy, danceable tune. I love the storytelling of country music, and that's what Mark does with his production and songs he writes and finds, Miley says. He gave me my very own classic country song, but with that twist that makes it work in clubs or on the radio. He's the master at that. Licky Lee, who sings on the title track, says, I think there is something about Mark's gentle spirit that unlocks vocals, especially female ones. Somehow, we all channeled that heartbreak that is real in all of us. The extraordinary gospel-based singer Yeba, who sings three songs on the album, says, Mark puts together the most forgotten shades of my emotions. I swear I found my own reflection somewhere in the making of this project. And King Princess, who is signed to Mark's own Zelig label, says, Mark is God, and I try to respect his opinions because I know he has great taste. Additionally, Alicia Keys, Camila Cabello, Angel Olsen, Ilse Juber, and Dodger round out the all-female cast. After many hours of conversation over 2 days at Electric Lady, Mark tells me, I'm lucky that my real success didn't happen until I was older. I've been up and down, and I was lucky that my big success came when I was 32, so I knew I wasn't going to squander it away. Some of the things that have happened to me in music are beyond anything I ever could have imagined. So now that he's checked off a lot of things on his wish list, Saturday Night Live, Grammy Awards, a Golden Globe, an Oscar, huge solo success, working with amazing talents, what's next? Well, he says, coming from a big family, he wants one of his own, so children will eventually be in the picture. But he tells me, as cliched as it sounds, my true heroes are people like Quincy Jones, who's made music that's meaningful in people's lives for 30 or 40 years. The only thing I wake up in the morning and care about and want to do is to be in the studio getting that feeling again to make a good piece of music. Now here's Claire Lansbaum on books. The Hot Seat, a new deep dive into the terms of 8 former presidents, is chock full of political hijinks and deja vu. In 1868, President Andrew Johnson found himself impeached and on trial before the U.S. Senate. Over the course of his term, he had essentially declared war on his own government, vetoing an outrageous 29 bills, firing officials without Senate permission, and pardoning old pals. Congress fought back. 15 vetoes were overridden, and after a nearly 3-month trial, Abe Lincoln's successor barely escaped conviction. The question of whether a president could govern while being on trial was a hot topic, writes Jared Cohen in Accidental Presidents, 8 Men Who Changed America, out this month from Simon and Schuster. Johnson clearly thought he could. Accidental Presidents, which focuses on the 8 men who assumed the office after their predecessors died, is littered with such germane lines. Recounting then-Vice President Chester Arthur's electioneering on behalf of James A. Garfield, Cohen writes that Arthur couldn't resist the urge to flaunt some of the shadier practices used to win. Other chapters flick at familiar themes: trust-busting, scandal-wrangling, and brawls that read like highbrow TMZ. William O. Butler lunged toward Thomas D. Arnold of Tennessee, choking him until his tongue protruded down to his cravat. Yes, we're polarized right now. Cohen, CEO of the tech incubator Jigsaw, and a former advisor to both Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton, tells Vanity Fair. Yes, politics is tense, but history helps us realize that we're actually, probably, going to be okay. The book is also a reminder that when it came to succession, America's founders basically winged it. If you think about how much we leave to chance, the fact that only Andrew Johnson was a disaster is really quite the miracle, Cohen says. Something to keep in mind for 2020? Perhaps. Until we start thinking of our vice president as someone who can be president, I don't believe that mentality will change.
Thank you.
Now on to the conversation. Scoop. Jessica Yellen spent 2 decades running the gauntlet from MSNBC to ABC and finally CNN before launching her own media brand, News Not Noise, last year. Savage News, her Romana Clef, sinks its fangs into the biz by Maggie Bullock. With illustration by Lauren Tamaki. Of Jessica Yellen, who started her career as a baby peon in the Clinton White House. The fun of the book is trying to discern truth from fiction. Who's who? It's an amalgam of experience. Nobody's a one-to-one. There's a scene where our heroine, Natalie, is trying to prove herself. She gets a scoop, and as soon as she goes on camera, her big moment, it comes out of her competition's mouth. Her boss gave it to him. In journalism, you make your name by getting scoops. If you're losing all your work, how do you get ahead? It's devastating. I gave that to friends to read, and across the board, people came back saying, "You have to take that scene out. It's implausible." I tell my reporter friends, and they double over laughing. They're like, "It happens all the time. Are you serious?" One of the biggest challenges is that the things people think are broad are real. Then there's the hair thing. Yes, you are clearly working through some kind of post-traumatic hair disorder. One day I got a little scoop, and I was on the White House lawn and got a call from management. I thought I was going to get an attaboy. I got, "Jessica, it appears as though your hair is 1/8 of an inch longer on one side than the other." From that day forward, everything was about my hair. Why do almost all women on news have straight hair? It's the process by which they make you part of the system, right? You've now gone through the machine. In one of the more disturbing scenes in your book, Natalie is trapped at an event by her boss, the chief. He's pressed up against her. He has her cornered. Yet her concern is how to get out of it without making him feel embarrassed. The point of that scene is, really, harassment doesn't always look like whipping it out or overtly asking for sex. It's these more insidious, uncomfortable, but deniable gray zone things that don't stop your career, but they undermine your confidence and your sense of stability. Did you write that with hashtag MeToo in mind? I wrote the book in 2015, well before hashtag MeToo. Friends who read it universally told me to take that stuff out. No one wants to hear that. Then the book is mostly finished and the Weinstein thing happens. Everyone's like, "Put it back in." Your portrayal of the news business is really pretty dark. I think it's describing a system that's broken. It's not any one place. It's not any one person. But here's a problem with how we are giving America the news. Right now, news is structured to appeal to the most base emotions, fear, panic, anxiety, outrage. My belief is you can tell the news in a different voice. How much of that is male versus female, though? I'm uncomfortable with the idea that the news has to be delivered differently to women. My philosophy is that women do approach things differently. It's not to avoid hard topics or only have happy things. It's how does it relate to me as a human? Why does this matter? Just get to the point and don't scream at me. I don't see why the news can't make you feel informed and calm, confident, and empowered. And that's what I really want to do. You've done social science research for News Not Noise. One of the things I've looked into is this pattern of news avoidance. Some people define it as people who aren't watching the news or watch only once a month. I think of it as people who seek news and then are turned off, disgusted, who pick it up and put it down. When I engage with women and my followers on Instagram, they say things like, "You've taken the toxicity out of news. Thank you." They're not trying to avoid the information. It's the rest of it, the cacophony. Do you miss the noise? After I left, I'd get a phone notification that the president had done something, and panic, I can't get to the camera. My mind would go there before I'd remember, oh, I don't have to do this, And then I would feel this joy, like, oh my God, I get to just have my day. From Fiorella Valdesolo comes this beauty article, Upward Spiral. Once a sign of feminine froideur, the bun is turning heads for its easy polish, with the occasional assist from a fancy scrunchie. That updo and uptight should find themselves linguistically tangled is no accident. It's often assumed that the former portends the latter. Women with a tidy bun are liable to be typecast as prim and proper, controlled, if not downright controlling. Harry Potter's headmistress cum witch, Minerva McGonagall, has her smarts and tough demeanor underscored by a permanent topknot. Lilith Sternan, the buttoned-up psychiatrist on Cheers, played by a mordant Bebe Neuwirth, wears her severity in her pulled-back hair, which became a frequent punchline on the long-running show. "At least get the tension on that bun checked," snaps the waitress Carla in one episode. "If that baby goes, we're all dead." What's at stake in losing a few bobby pins? A different kind of unraveling, as the age-old tropes of the sexy librarian and the Shakespearean madwoman spell out. Letting your hair down is synonymous with going wild. At a time when women are climbing the ranks and looking to signal unflappable incompetence, why not tie up loose ends? Everything we do to our hair sends a message to people, and a very tight, clean bun has a connotation of power and confidence, says editorial hairstylist Guido Palau, who masterminds the runway looks for Prada, Marc Jacobs, and Valentino. In the recent fall shows, sleek chignon with defined parts, seen at Brandon Maxwell and self-portrait, acted as the beauty equivalent of a power suit. For freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the bun means happiness. The bun means business, much like her signature red lip, but it's as grounded in common sense as her policy ideas. The hairstyle's appeal is that its elegance is gratifyingly easy to achieve. It's utilitarian and unfussy, and it allows women to feel a bit freer about putting themselves together, says Sophie Bahai, a Los Angeles jewelry designer and mother of a toddler. If the popular beauty lexicon has given us the man bun, add to that the mom bun. Bahai likes to embellish her own impossibly chic knot with a modernist silver clip, or one of her line's organza scrunchies, a highbrow framing device. The bun suits my lifestyle, but also just my style. Meghan Markle would likely agree. Her signature messy bun, a low-key contrast to sister-in-law Kate Middleton's glossy blowout, has inspired countless Google searches and YouTube tutorials. Considering its utility with baby handling, it will no doubt continue to be in her regular hairstyle rotation. The bun will always be relevant because it's so multifaceted in that it can go from casual to more polished, says hairstylist David Millett. On the days between washes, clients at his Soignier Paris and New York salons often resort to a single escargot, his preferred term, always secured with a long hairpin, never an elastic. It will leave a break mark in your strand. For more of that lived-in feel, stylist George Northwood, who counts Markle as a client, adds a spritz of dry shampoo at the roots to give hair some guts. Perhaps the most evolved way to think about hair right now is not to overthink it, a task the bun gamely accomplishes. And by pulling hair off the face, there's an opportunity to minimize distraction and invite attention back where it belongs. The bun is just a more modern idea of something sexy, rather than long curls or tousled bedhead, adds Buhai. Those powers of seduction that TV audiences were made to believe Lilith couldn't channel until her hair came down, they were wrapped up in her bun all along. to Oscar. At Vanity Fair's Oscar Bash, the effect was sheer magic as stars collided, reveling in the reflected sparkle by Julie Miller. Shortly after Lady Gaga and Mark Ronson arrived inside Vanity Fair's annual Oscar party at a custom-designed venue alongside the Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts in Beverly Hills, the Shallow songwriters clinked glasses and statues. Around them, stars from the film, sports, political, tech, and fashion worlds were in full celebration mode. Tina Fey, Maya Rudolph, Amy Poehler, and Natalie Portman hit the dance floor for Belle Biv DeVoe's Poison. Glenn Close snacked on French fries from Nomad Los Angeles with Gayle King and posed for a selfie with Steven Spielberg. Frances McDormand declared, "I need tequila," pausing en route to the bar to show off the Birkenstocks underneath her fuchsia Valentino. Nearby, J.J. Abrams led Shonda Rhimes, Monica Lewinsky, and Game of Thrones co-creator David Benioff in an impromptu toast. Jennifer Lopez and Alex Rodriguez grooved to the a cappella group that welcomed guests to the red carpet, while Melissa McCarthy and husband Ben Falcone boogied in matching black tracksuits under kinetic lights that undulated to the beat of the music. Taylor Swift made an appearance, waving off photographers with her boyfriend Joe Alwyn. When Spike Lee arrived, adapted screenplay Oscar in hand, Vin Diesel whooped congratulations, and Close, invigorated from the infusion of carbs and goodwill, joined the dance floor for Donna Summer's Bad Girls as admirers circled around her. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.